Open session tonight on the inside track. It's been very controversial and accepted since last, what was it, Wednesday? We did a show with George Norrie on Coast to Coast, which was repeated already. And then on Monday night, another doctor, get his name, talked about the mind control and stuff and electronic means to further enhance what we'd already said. So go to bbsradio.com to call in. And I will go there myself right now and give you some call-in phone numbers so that you can call in tonight on various topics. Because a lot of you, of course, we on the Coast to Coast, you were not able to actually get your questions in. So the call-in numbers are toll-free from U.S. Canada, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Some of the line, and you can also get this on your cell phone. Just go to the bbsradio.com to get your cell phone information. Another call-in number is 530-327-7602. And there's a bunch of other numbers there, too, but that should get you started. Well, buddy, what do you think? You think that was a big show the other night. Unfortunately, you couldn't run the Coast to Coast show. They don't allow birds yet. Well, they just don't allow birds. You know that. So we were talking about a lot of stuff the other night. A lot of interesting things. Started out, we didn't really get a chance to cover the different scientists. But the book goes back in society 8,000 years. The reason it goes back that far in science is because that's where modern science today, as we know it, started. And that's when farming began, you know, in groups and all this kind of stuff. And so that's where we start the book. And then after we, actually the very beginning of the book, we go into some basic stuff of science, so you have a basic understanding of what's in the book. But I break everything down into parentheses and subtitles and stuff. So if a word comes up, like if you're like me, you're too lazy to go look it up in the dictionary. But what I learned is that when you read a book, come to a word that you don't understand, then you need to look that word up and understand it, because beyond that, you'll never understand what you're reading. And actually, when I started out, I went back 250,000 years to Lemuria and 12,000 years to Atlantis, but I'm not going to go into that now. So we follow the civilization all the way through. Archimedes, for example, was a great a Greek inventor who invented all kinds. He invented the screw, which actually allows water to be screwed up through pipes. But he also developed all kinds of anti, you know, war machines. And when the there was a war, for example, he had, when they tried to invade Greece, he would have big buckets that would grab ships out, hang out over the ocean, grab ships and turn them over, and all kinds of stuff like that. And finally, when the Romans took over, they had great respect for him, but one of the Roman soldiers didn't understand him too well, so he killed him, but against the general's orders. So he, great guy, met a, you know, in the end. We talk about Imhotep. He was the counterpart of Quetzalcoatl, which we talk about, who was a South American, or actually, South American, pretty much, god, who was the possible Pleiadian extraterrestrial connection to bring science to the Pleiades, like I have done, but an earlier version of it, which became very famous through the Mayan science. Imhotep was in Egypt. He served under the Egyptian pharaoh Dozier, who reigned in Egypt from 2632 to 2611, and he was like the first medical doctor. Plus, he was an inventor. And we go back and cover these guys, and then we just come up to Kepler and Descartes and Newton and all the ones that that you've all heard. And then we come into chapter 4. We go into the coming of electricity and magnetism, which I call the cornerstones of the quantum world. And we start off, of course, with every time you look at a $100 bill, say, come on now, $100 bill, what do you see? Old Benji, Benjamin Franklin. And we have the true story there about how he really did the electricity with the key. And a couple of guys, I mean, this is not a normal mainstream science, but a couple of the guys, scientists in those days, tried to duplicate his experiments, but they did not isolate themselves from ground and got electrocuted. That's a true story. So all this funny stuff is always going on, you know. And, trying to see what's wrong with my chat. By the way, we have a chat room over on Ustream. Doesn't seem to be working tonight. You never know what's going on with Ustream. Try it one more time. Link mode disabled. Oh, here we go. Okay, guys. I see that people are signing in now. I never know what goes on with Ustream. So anyway, Rathboss got his book yesterday. Are you in England, Rathboss? Where are you located? Type it in there. Pennsylvania. Well, Pittsburgh. All right. I've been to Pittsburgh many times. I used to call on some military installations there. Glad you guys don't have any snow. You must be laying out in the sun, getting a suntan this afternoon. You're probably working on your tan. What is it, about 80 back there? Come on out to California and get rained on. I love it. Yeah, my people talk to me. You can go on Fred Bell Show on Ustream if you don't know where that is. Good place to go. We're missing Vroom Vroom or whatever his name is. Where the heck's he at tonight? You know, I have my followers here that are in the chat room, and I always look for them, but we've only got one follower tonight or one special warrior on the line. So anyway, Michael Faraday, we cover him. Andre Marie Ampere. Andre was real interesting because, you know, you heard, how many amps have you got? You know, you hear the, you know, somebody's amped up, you know? Well, that's an electrical music, music. It's an electrical term from Andre Marie Ampere, who was born on January 22nd, 1775 in France. And he was cool. And it's a whole story about these guys. I mean, about their love life and how they cheated on their girlfriends and wives and stuff. I mean, this is a get-down-and-dirty book. It's very interesting, but everybody had, you know, all of the crazy scientists are whacked out somehow because I didn't put my shortcomings in here, and they're already pretty much all over the Internet. Johann Carl Friedrich Gauss, you know, he's the measurement of magnetics. He's in here. J.J. Thompson's in here. He's the one that discovered the electron. Thomas Edison's in here. We only gave Thomas Edison three paragraphs because he wasn't very nice to Nikola Tesla, who follows him. We got one, two, three, four pages in here. So we really covered Nikola Tesla really well. Oh, gosh, Room Broom had trouble getting online. What's the matter? What's the problem? We covered Carl Ernst Ludwig Marx Planck. Planck was pretty famous. Planck constant defined, you know, the smallest measurement before we don't exist anymore, basically. He's in here. Okay. Many pages. And there's so much stuff that we covered in this book, you know, just in the very beginning. Bird. Albert Einstein is covered. Now, we get into the second chapter, skip the chapter here. Skip a little bit. I jumped this puppy a little bit. Yeah, chapter 5. was the true beginnings of the quantum age. So what I did is I broke this book down a bit from the early science, and then we started categorizing science. And the true beginnings of the quantum age, from classical physics to the illusion of existence, is what it's called. The saying under that is, old physicists don't die, their wave functions go to zero as time goes to infinity. Okay? I'll read that over again. Old physicists don't die, their wave functions go to zero as time goes to infinity. That makes sense, I'm sure it does. So Max Planck was probably one of the fathers of nuclear physics. And we cover Niels Bohr, Werner Heisenberg, the Heisenberg Uncertainty Principle, Pauli, Wolfgang Pauli, oh, there's so many guys. Schrodinger and the Schrodinger's cat, I'm sure a lot of you have heard about that. Then we get more into Charles Wee Thompson. He was a meteorologist. I actually was a meteorologist too. He did a lot of information developing the Wilson Cloud Chamber. And when I was at the University of Michigan working with Dr. Donald Katz, who came over here on Paperclip. Paperclip was a project. I mean, Paperclip is where all the Nazi top level people came over with total immunity and went to work in different government positions. Like Wernher von Braun came over on, who I also worked for on Paperclip. But Donald Katz was Donald L. Katz was the first guy that I worked for at the University of Michigan. He was actually my teacher. I was a student. A special program for gifted young kids, where weird young kids. I shouldn't say gifted. I don't know what the gifts were. I haven't found them yet. Still looking. Santa Claus, where's my gift? But anyway, it was real interesting. So we have this cyclotron, and in order to see these subatomic particles that we, we talk about, like positron, there's an electron, but then smash, it became a positron, and it only lasted for a billionth of a second, that kind of stuff. That's where we used the Wilson Cloud Chamber, and later on the Bubble Chamber. Then we cover Henri Bergier, Gerard Casimir, and you've heard of the Casimir effect, and that's where a lot of your flying saucer stuff comes from, in the quantized fields of the Casimir work of him. And even some of the newest stuff that's being done in Area 51 works on the Casimir effect. So that's on page 102. So it gives you a little background on him. Not every day I get to go over the chapters like we are today. Then we go into Edwin Powell Hubble. Now, you all know we have the Hubble telescope up there, and it's doing these wondrous things because it doesn't have to blaze its way through the Earth's atmosphere and therefore get a loss of clarity. And believe it or not, I bet a lot of you, Edwin Powell Hubble was born August 19, 1991, died June 1892, okay? How many of you know out here what he really did? I mean, I bet a lot of you don't know what he really was. He went to the University of Chicago, concentrated on mathematics, astronomy, and philosophy. He also went as a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, as Bill Clinton did, and studied law. Then he returned to the U.S. He taught Spanish, physics, and mathematics in the New Albany High School in New Albany, Indiana. And he was offered a staff position at Mount Wilson out here in California, in Pasadena. But what did he really do? Does anybody know? I don't see anything on the chat room. William Powell Hubble was a boxer. He was a world heavyweight boxer and could have won the world championship. He could have been like Muhammad Ali. That's the true story. Yeah, William Powell Hubble of the Hubble Telescope, very famous scientist, was a boxer. He would punch your lights out. That's what he did, and he made a decision after he'd reached the point where he was ready to go up and fight for the World Heavyweight Championship to give up boxing and devote himself to science. It's the 11th hour. That's who he was. So that's in here. So, I mean, this gives you an idea of, and I've just covered a little bit of it. This book's 400 pages long, and we're only up to 104. Gives you an idea of where what these scientists were all about, what they were doing. E.O. Lawrence, Ernest Orlando Lawrence, He invented the cyclotron. And, of course, I worked with the cyclotron. He did this back in 1929. And a cyclotron is a device, you know, you've heard of the Large Hadron Collider that's over in CERN in Switzerland, in France. It's kind of, not France, but Switzerland and Italy and all the places it goes. It's 30 miles in diameter. Okay, the predecessor to that was the cyclotron. And what we do is we accelerate deuterons from the cyclotron, which are heavy hydrogen particles, and we smash them into things like calcium, and we look for new elements, like we're looking for element 119, element 120, which are theoretically forecasted in physics. So we're looking for that kind of stuff. But E.O. Lawrence was the guy that did the cyclotron in 1929 at Berkeley that started this whole thing off now. And guess how he did it? He was in a restaurant and he drew out a diagram for it on a napkin in a restaurant. He got the idea in a restaurant. So, I mean, it's like, what's his name's cat, you know, Schrodinger's cat. He was with his girlfriend. I guess he had a threesome going with his wife. And he was up in the Swiss Alps with his girlfriend on vacation when he came up with the stuff that he did, his main thing about the Schrodinger equations and that. So, I mean, all these guys, there's some real wackos out here. I mean, you guys put me in a... Leo Szilard, another guy, he's the guy that was underneath the Chicago stadium at the University of Chicago and created the first nuclear fission reaction, which, of course, created the bomb that bombed Japan. John Archibald Wheeler, brilliant guy. He was the teacher to Richard Feynman. Richard Feynman was one of my role models. I didn't teach the same classes with Richard Feynman, but he and I were together a lot of times at Esalen in Northern California back when we were both giving our respective classes. Of course, Richard worked at Los Alamos and the Manhattan Project. He worked on the development of the atomic bomb, like a lot of those guys. And the sad thing about that, the work at Los Alamos was that they didn't understand radiation. And most of those guys died of radiation poisoning, which is, of course, cancer, including Richard. His wife, there's a movie out. I'm trying to remember the name of the movie. It's a beautiful movie about Richard Feynman's wife, and they were married at a very young age. He met her in high school, and got tuberculosis, was misdiagnosed. She had ended up dying in a hospital in Albuquerque, New Mexico, while Richard Feynman was working up north, just up in the road about 60 miles. And Richard used to borrow this guy's car. Forget his name, it's in here, I'll come to it in a minute, but he borrowed his car to drive down there. He turned out to be a spy for the Russians and got arrested after the bomb was built. But later on he was exuberated and exonerated, and he came back out and went to work for our government again, even though he was convicted of being a Russian spy. I mean, it's a crazy story in here because it's all about intelligence. It's all about... It's all about, you know, what was going on. Murray Gell-Mann was another one that was a good friend of Richard Feynman. And Murray Gell-Mann still lives. He's 83 years old. And he's the one that discovered the quark. I'm sure you've heard about the quark, which there's three different quarks, two up, two down in a hydrogen atom. And different atoms have different amounts of quarks, and up and down. And up and down means, up means the positive two-third, down means a minus one-third charge. So you end up getting the atomic charge by, if it's an up, it's positive two-thirds, you know, and it's not a whole charge. Like, you know, you look at 1 volt, that's a charge of 1 volt. In this area of physics, which are subatomic particles, you have, you know, fractions of charge. And you can take these different fractions and invert them. And when you invert them, you end up having different, you could have 1.5 charge, which then makes, you know, some other element. And it's all really cool stuff. It's all in here how that works. Murray Gell-Mann right now is located in Arizona. He's 80-some years old, world famous, Nobel Peace Prize kind of guy. And he is studying the origin of languages now. So I would, if you want to, I'll have him on the show. He's coming on the show. But we want to get more books out. It's MURRAYGELL-MANN, Murray Gell-Mann. You really want to follow him a little bit. And the six types of quark. Richard Feynman, Richard Philip Feynman. He was my all-time idol. The problem is with me, I mean, I didn't know who he was when I knew him. I knew him as some famous physicist at Caltech. I had no idea he'd been at the, you know, building atomic bombs, and story of his girlfriend and Arlene Greenbaum, his wife, would make a huge movie. It's just I had no idea. I'm trying to see if I had that movie in here, by the way, so you can go get it. You got to see the movie. I mean, if you can get it on video, and it's available everywhere. But just look up Richard Feynman. It's spelled F-E-Y-N. That's F-E-Y-N-M-A-N. And then film. And you will get the name of that real quick. Looking through the book. You really got to see this movie. It's the most beautiful love story. And it was a very, very well accepted film. See it here. Apologize for not having the film on the top of my head. But anyway, there's many pages on his work. He's brilliant. He got a Nobel Peace Prize, by the way, for quantum color dynamics. We in our products here at Pyridyn use a lot of quantum mechanics, and he had developed a colorization in math. And got a Nobel Peace Prize for, I think it was 1965, which he bought a house somewhere. And he also did the famous Feynman diagram. And so he was quite a guy. He did most of his work at Gioni's Steakhouse, which was located at 1453 North Lake Avenue in Pasadena on Thursdays. And this, by the way, was called a bottomless bar. Richard Feynman did, he's not married, so it's okay. His wife had died earlier. So he's working in a bottomless bar, doing all these field equations for physics, getting a Nobel Peace Prize. Finally, the cops closed it down, and he went to court because that area wasn't zoned for a bottomless bar. Now, this is back in, 1969. He was in the Los Angeles article, November 8, 1969, entitled, this is the LA Times, right? Bottomless Phelps Nobel physicist with figures, written by Jack Birkinshaw, describes Richard's court appearances trying to keep Angelo, that's the guy that owned the bar, keep his bar open after the city of Pasadena tried to close it down. Eventually, of course, it all closed down. I mean, give me a break. If this isn't fun stuff, how much wilder can it get? Dr. Edward Teller, he's in here. Peter Ware Higgs, dang. Yeah, there's lots of guys. Michio Kaku. Now, there's a guy. We've had him on the show already. Leonard Susskind. I've talked to him several times. Leonard Susskind and is working on the space-time singularities. He's up in Northern California. He works with Gerard de Hooft, another very famous Dutch scientist. You're going to see more of their names come up. And by the way, he's a Felix Bloch professor at Stanford University. We've had some pretty nice conversations. And as well as Michio Kaku, who is one of the founders and proponents of the string theory, which is the bottom of the core of quantum mechanics and physics today. Kip Stephen Thorne is in here. He's doing some amazing work on gravity waves. Now, that's a real interesting topic. Now, this is the stuff we didn't cover on George Norrie that we're going over. If you want the stuff covered in detail on this show, just go to Coast to Coast AM, type in February 4th, and go into the archives and listen to it. But anyway, it was real interesting. Michio Kaku was awesome. Victor Schaumburger's in here. Now, Victor worked for the Third Reich early on. He was old when he worked for him. And he built the, called the Trout Turbine. And what happened was, he observed, he was a naturist, you know, he loved nature. So he observed trout swimming upstream, but not along the edge of the stream. where the water wasn't flowing against them so hard, but flowing upstream in the middle where the hardest powerful current going the wrong way was. And he found out by his research that the gravity, specific gravity, or the weight of that fish in that point of the energy flow with water was less. So therefore, the fish was actually exuberating less energy going upstream in the highest point of the current rather than going to the side and swimming up lazily, because he was getting a quantum push from the energy stream itself. And of course, if you out there as a person could get a quantum push, then your life would be a lot better, so you could learn from a trout, you know, and that's what he did. It's an entanglement principle that transfers energy from the center of a singularity in a black hole directly into your DNA, which then goes into your ATP cells, adenosine triphosphate cells, which unlock the sugar. It creates the sugar, it turns the sugar in your body into pure energy. That's why if you have a five-year-old, you give him a candy bar, he's out of control for 3 hours, because his ATP is working very good. So Schomburger did all that. He built flying saucers for the government. Then I jump back to Edwin Babbitt and Annie Besant. And the reason I jumped into them is because they were the ones that discovered the Anu and the sub. They were the first. I'm quiet over here. They were the first discoverers of the subatomic particles, but they had different names for them. But their numbers and weights and measures later on got integrated by a physicist named Stephen Phillips, who wrote a book called The Extrasensory Perception of Quarks, and is now considered part of mainstream work, even though they weren't exactly orthodox scientists. David Bohm, there's a guy that died in 92, David Joseph Bohm, B-O-H-M. He's somebody you might want to look up, one of my role models. And my role models are people that, through my life, made a profound statement that motivated me to do different studies and sometimes make discoveries. And I have comments from all these guys. You know, I have tons of comments from Einstein, because a lot of you have heard them, and I've got some you never heard. And I didn't make them up. In some sense, man is a microcosm of the universe. Therefore, what man is included in the universe. We are enfolded in the universe. He says, another thing, thought has been constantly evolving, and we can't say when that system began. David Bohm was born on December 20th, Sagittarius, 1917, died October 27, 92. He's the one that brought out the hologram, the physics. He presented, you know, we all hear about it, oh, the hologram, this is a hologram, you know. You know, we see holograms when we go to Disneyland, or we see when they do an interference pattern with lasers over a photograph that's shot with laser scans. And we see all that. And that's a hologram. And that's really cool stuff. And so anyway, David Bohm, he's one of my role models. You should read some of his books. They're written down to the terrestrial level of understanding. Now here, we are now going to pause for a commercial. Hey, we're having shawootsi here. Buddy Boo? Shawootsi. The best herb on the planet. It'll wet your whistle. Available at Paradigm. Shawootsi. Caligala multiform. Herb that refreshes, embellishes, and gets rid of any kind of radiation storage in your body. Then we finally, after Joseph Bohm, we have chapter 7. Dun, 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 dun. There it is. The emergence of evils, combined intelligence in today's world, the flu, the prison, the plague, the plan. So this is where we start getting into the meat. If you guys we're running out of time, so you know, if you got questions, you better call in. Otherwise, you're going to get left behind. on the Art Bell show when I do George Norrie Art Bell. There's no time to call in. So anyhow, the flu, the prison, the plan, and then it says children are expendable. Then there's a little saying from Thomas Jefferson. When people fear their government, there is tyranny. When the government fears the people, there is liberty. That's Thomas Jefferson, who had 5 kids, half of them died of pneumonia, and 2 wives had died on him. Guy didn't have a life. He's in here, too. Think about this, guys. Regardless of whether you're in the United States of America or some other country like Great Britain, when the people fear their government, there is tyranny. When the government fears the people, there is liberty. Thomas Jefferson, one of my favorite sayings here. So, I spent 20 years with the National Health Federation, and that was a while back, and that seems like yesterday. And 20 years is like, yep. And the book starts out, the history of epidemics, pandemics, and plagues, and it breaks each one down from what it is. But he's all quiet. Oh, he's working his thing. So I cover all the diseases, what are called epidemic diseases, anthrax, bacillary, dynasty, botulism, brucelliosis, cholera, pseudorosis, hepatitis, paratyphoid, and typhoid fever. These are the first ones that I cover. And then there's the host-to-host epidemic diseases. Diphtheria, otovinus pulmonary syndrome, and that's very similar to the meningitis, cockal meningitis, pneumococcal pneumonia, tuberculosis, whooping cough, German measles, and influenza and measles. We explain the sources, the carriers, the reservoirs, and how where it comes from, whether it comes from food, fecal contamination, and water. It's all laid out so you can. Somebody out there wants a bottle of Shaanxi, it looks like. Then we go to host epidemics. Okay, we went from the epidemic diseases. Now we're in host-to-host epidemics, and we have HIV, chlamydia, which is a big college disease, gonorrhea, syphilis, trichomonas. That comes from, trichomonas, they talk about it as a vaginal prostate secretion, but it actually is, if you go back, it's these people that are doing that have eaten ham or pork. That comes from pork, and it's if you look at, there's some things on the internet where you can cook a piece of pork and then pour Coca-Cola on it, and worms show up. There you go. Then the vector-borne. These are vector-borne diseases. Epidemic typhus, Lyme disease, malaria, plague, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, cystadococcus, rabies, and tularemia. These are, that's from rabbits, by the way. If you want to get tularemia, you can mess around with rabbits. But anyhow, sheep is what people mostly mess with. So then I go into the history of plagues, bubonic plague, and then we go into the threats since 1900, and then it gets into, then we start, it starts getting good. Like, for example, we start looking at America, and, what happened here. At Fort Riley, this Fort Riley is where the Spanish flu started, the virus. 50 million people died. Okay, 675,000 died in the U.S. alone. All right, where did this come from? Well, it was first observed at Fort Riley, which happened to be the home of General George Custer and the 7th Cavalry in Kansas, the United States, on March 4, 1918, and in Queens, New York, on March 11, 1918. The disease killed 600,000 people in the U.S. and 20 to 50 million wives. Worldwide. That was a little bit of a thing there. They were messing around with something and they got out of control. If it comes out of a fort, you can bet they were messing with it because, Fort Riley was one of the earlier places. Of course, Fort Dix is right now the big place. In 1957, we had the Asian flu. We had the Hong Kong flu, 68, virus, swine flu. That was a little bit of, another swine flu, identified at Fort Dix. Hello. It was labeled the killer flu. This is where Donald Rumsfeld came in, started trying to make his money. And, by the way, just so you know it, Fort Dix is at Burlington County, New Jersey, and it's the largest U.S. federal prison. Not only is it the largest U.S. federal prison, it also is the largest federal prison where experimentation goes on. Okay, in 77 we had the Russian flu virus. Okay, Russian flu. And that was pretty bad. That wasn't that bad. Then we had the avian flu, 97. The new Asian flu in 99. And it goes on and on and on. Now, here's an interesting, I'm going to read this out of the book. The question is the flu a manufactured virus? And now, flashing back to October 21st, 2005, a deputy of the ultra-nationalist liberal democratic faction of the Russian state, Duma Alexei Mitrofanov, said in a parliamentary speech, the Russian guy, he's pretty high up there, he's a deputy, that the bird flu was invented by Americans who wanted to dominate the world's poultry market. The idea of a pandemic among humans is something from science fiction. Spanish agricultural minister Olenia Epizoa said on a private radio station, Condesur, as Europe braced for the further spread of H5N1 strain of what I call the fake bird flu. Dr. Mark Siegel is a practicing internist, associate professor at the University of New York, University School of Medicine, stated that if anything is contagious right now, it's judgment clouded by fear. And, you know, after writing this chapter, I found it necessary to revisit this part. If you remember back in 2005 and 6, Donald Rumsfeld and company pushed the news media as hard as they could by creating the avian flu scare. Right, what this Russian was talking about, October 21, 2005, when he made the statement. Okay? So it seems like just a few weeks ago, around the middle of April 2009, I was writing the book when this happened, and released we released the newer designer virus designed at Fort Dix back in 1976. Of course, this was the avian flu. Remember, once again, I say, remember, this largest federal corrections institute that loves to do biological experiments. Republican Ron Paul, which I know a lot of you guys at BBS Radio supported, a medical doctor by trade, commented that it is definitely must have been a man-made virus. Mexico is a logical place to start a false pandemic, as recently there have been border disputes, drug running disputes, and other issues between the United States and Mexico. Think about that. Ron, I already said it, and then I got a statement from Ron Paul saying the same thing. I was saying the same thing. Before Ron Paul said it, I said it. But when he said it, I printed it, and I put his name on it, because people believe him more than me. He's a politician. You know. So that's where, so there is a point where, you know, they started to spread this shit worldwide. Now this is where Gilead comes in. G-I-L-E-A-D, science. Who is the largest? Who owns 5 million shares of Gilead Science? Well, I'll give you a clue. He was defense minister twice in this country. Came in under Gerald Ford. Was at that time president of a company that was making a product called Asparidine. Asparidine was shown in tests to kill people. The FDA was going to kill Asparidine. He fired the FDA supervisor and appointed his own during General Ford. So now he had control of the FDA. Asparidine was approved, but not by the FDA. They just didn't say anything. Who are we talking about? Who made $45 million in the latter months of last year on fake swine flu promises? It is Donald Rumsfeld. Of course you all knew that. And that's in here. Big opening moment. For Donald Rumsfeld, take the stage. He looks a little strange anyway. I'd like to see somebody to put some swine flu in his bucket, you know? That would be really cool. So there's so much propaganda. Then of course the big scare. Now here's the deal, okay? When they start pushing the swine flu at the same time in July 27th through 30 last year, that's 2009, those of you that don't remember what year this is, and it's cool if you don't, I would like to be in your league. What happened was, during that end of July, we had five different countries provide troops. So it was England and France and Germany, Italy, and one other country, not worth mentioning. That brought over their troops, and they were training our military, plus their military, how to come up to your house, you know, you listeners out there in the United States of America, USA guys, not just Canada and other people, knock on your door and come into your house and take your guns, weapons, or maybe you, and declare martial law, okay? They were all trained for that. And then, of course, we have those 800 prisons that are run by the Army right now that are empty except for a few stragglers that, right now, they're only using them for, you know, intermittent detention centers for illegal immigrants. So that's their temporary quarters before they get deported or waterboarded, depending on what they're going to do with them. So anyway, Jones got Rumsfeld. Yeah, good, Jones. I knew you. Well, he doesn't cap, though. He's on top of this stuff. So anyway, that's kind of what's going on with martial law, you know. And so that was all set up. But, you know, thanks to people out there like Alex Jones, myself, others, we raised holy hell because we realized that this was a fascist tactic. We all saw it, you know. Maybe you guys didn't. Well, I'm sure a lot of you did. I know Jones saw it. Anyway, as a fascist tactic, what they do is they try something extreme like that was, you know, getting these foreign troops to run around and bust your chops. And if the American public or anybody or any public resists their efforts, as we did, and protests through the news, as we did, then they don't try it. It's a failure right now. They'll try it. They'll come back and try it again. They never give up. But right now, we push this whole martial law thing back. And so that got pushed back. But meanwhile, Rumsfeld made over $50 million on selling the Tamiflu, we haven't gotten to that yet. We might not even get to it today. I don't know. It's already 5:50. So anyway, we go on through all of that. And we talk about the Rex program. 84 was established for the mass exodus of illegal aliens crossing the Mexican-U.S. border, where they would be quickly rounded up and placed in FEMA detention centers, which is what these prisons are. Operation Garden Plot is a program to control the old population. Operation Cable Splicer is a program for orderly takeover of state and local governments by federal government. FEMA is the executive arm of the police, up-and-coming police state, blah, blah, blah. All these little programs that you've never heard about, haven't been on the Internet, that I have, you know, access to, are in this book, just so you know. It's interesting. Oh, my gosh. So, anyhow, population control. And the guy that started this, it's real interesting. At this point, we get into the, you know, I was going to put this in the book, but I didn't. What I was going to put in the book and didn't was how you at home could go and take a couple of animal viruses and make your own killer and mix them with a human virus and make your own disease. And that, I was going to put that in there. It's not that hard. For about $50 worth of, you know, chemistry supplies and Erlenmeyer flasks and test tubes and that and a Bunsen burner, you can actually make your own viruses. This is not a lost art by any means. First-year college chemist, I would say, you've got to be a first-year college chemist or a very good senior high school chemist, you know, would be able to create these viruses. And all you got to do is inject them into one human being and let them spread, okay? But anyhow, the guy that you guys really want to hate, all right, put him on your hate list. Dr. Jeffrey Tonnenberger, Fort Detrick, Maryland. began work in 1997 to recreate the 1918 killer virus, and this odious task was successfully completed in the year 2003. In his little report in 1997, this salacious little guy wrote, "The Spanish influenza pandemic killed at least 20 million people in 1918-19, making it the worst infectious pandemic in history. Understanding the origins of the 1918 virus and the basis for its exceptional virulence may aid in the prediction of future influenza pandemics. An RNA from a victim of the 1918 pandemic was isolated from a formalin-fixed, paraffin-embedded lung tissue sample. 9 fragments of viral DNA were sequenced to the coding regions of the hemagglutinin, neuroidase, nucleoprotein matrix protein 1, and matrix protein 2. These sequences are consistent with a novel H1N1 virus, a virus that incorporates a subgroup of strains that infect humans and swine, as well as avian subgroups. And if you want to go get more information from what I have in the book, it's www.sciencemag.org. And then when you get there, I'm just going to read it off. It's a CGI content abstract, and the number is 275-530-7179. But you'll find it at www.sciencemag.org, and just type in swine flu. And then here's the other thing that came up. When pressed by researchers, now his colleagues are saying, why are you doing this, you know? When pressed by researchers as to the reason he would undertake such a controversial project as recreate such a deadly pathogen, Tonnenberger defended his work. He's defending his work. This bad guy, write him a letter. Dr. Jeffrey Tonnenberger at Fort Detrick. Send him an email. Okay, he defends his work by declaring that a genetically recreating the virus in a petri dish was necessary, as it would allow the development of a vaccine to fight it. Hello, it's been extinct forever. 1997, this virus was as extinct as dinosaurs. Dinosaurs, as you know, were very extinct. Except him. He's obviously one, reincarnated. Tonnenberger's reasoning is flawed. Why genetically recreate a deadly Velociraptor dinosaur merely to create an advanced weapon to destroy it? Isn't it strange that the CDC, Center for Disease Control, and the WHO, that's the World Health Organization, are telling the world today that this pandemic is a new subtype of A/H1N1 virus not previously detected in swine or humans? This novel H1N1 influenza swine flu virus is a triple recombinant, including gene segments of human swine and avian origin. Isn't this Dr. Tannenberg's 1997 discovery? And of course, it all went downhill. So, anyway, that's a little session out of just a piece of book. Those of you guys that are just checking it, Inside Track, you can order it through www.pyridine.com or type in Dr. Fred Bell on your search engine, any one of them. Take you to Pyridine with an 800 number. We're selling right now the first 1,000 that I printed, which were the ones that have serial numbers and signed, and these are always worth the most money. A lot of my books became classics over the years, cult favorites or whatever, which is an honor. And this one will, too. And then this one will go to a publisher, and then it becomes a $27 book. But it won't be worth what this one will be worth 10 years from now. But it's kind of cool, you know. It's like on our nuclear receptors that you hear us talk about. Oh, baby. We have those things appraised. And it started about 10, 15 years ago, and they actually are jewelry. Not only is it functional, you know, but it is accepted by jewelers, and it has got a brand, some designer of clothes. It has that mystique to it now, which has an appraisable value to it that it appreciates, depending on when a piece was made. But anyhow, our call-in number, and we're out of time. You stop that. We're done. All right. He wants a nut. He wants some apple juice. What do you want? So we're running out of time here, as usual, and we're going to get kicked off the air in a minute. We're going to, the music you hear, by the way, in the background there, is from our album, From Andromeda with Love, with my band Voyager, or our band Voyager, with people from Kenny Loggins, George Winston's on there, a lot of people that you know are part of this band. We do it like a Traveling Wilburys band was before Roy Orbison died, where I have a bunch of guys that are pretty cool and pretty well known down and make music. So we are signing off. You've been listening to Dr. Fred Bell's Health Science and Energy Show. My phone number is 1-800-729-2603. Give us a call. Email is fredbell@paradigm.com. This week we'll be at the Conscious Life Expo at the Los Angeles Hilton. And I'll be lecturing up there. George Norrie will be there. A lot of people will be there. This weekend, Los Angeles Hilton. About 20,000 people will show up. Come and see me. I'm lost.